good night.
Hello, cocktail lovers. Welcome to Paris Cocktail Talk, the show brought to you by the 52 Martinis Guide to Paris Cocktail Bars. I'm Forrest Collins, and I'm here to talk to you about cocktailing in the French capital and bring you some other small batch boozy news from France and beyond. So, this month, we are going to be seeing the arrival of the Beaujolais Nouveau. Normally, it comes out on the third Thursday of the month, and, you know, it's kind of a fun thing. We see the bars making a big deal about it in France and also in the U.S. I think that it kind of makes a little bit of a splash. I think it comes out the week before Thanksgiving, so I'm sure there'll be plenty of Thanksgiving tables with the latest Deboeuf bottle on them. So I want to talk a little bit about that because, you know, it's just kind of a fun November thing. But I also want to talk a little bit about some of the more interesting aspects of the Beaujolais region itself outside of the Beaujolais Nouveau hype. So in order to do so, I've invited Aaron Ayskov down here into the studio to talk a little bit more about it. He is the writer of the site Not Drinking Poison in Paris. He's also written for the New York Times, the Financial Times. He does some writing for Punch as well as some other sites. We'll put those in the show notes. But Aaron, welcome. Thanks for taking the time to come down and talk to us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Did I miss anything that you might want to let the listeners know about in terms of what you do and your knowledge on wine?
No, I mean, that about covers it.
Well, as we were talking about just before we started recording, you spent some time down in the Beaujolais from 2015 to 2016, and you go back regularly now doing some research. What drew you to Beaujolais in the first place?
I love the wines, and there isn't already a good book on it, so I set myself the task of trying to exhaustively research the region in order to be able to say something definitive or authoritative, let's say, about the terroir down there and the ways of making wine.
Okay. And so for the listeners who are unfamiliar, Beaujolais is it's a wine region in France. It's a Gamay is the red grape you'll get down there, Chardonnay, a little bit of Aligoté. Am I missing anything?
No
Aligoté. Okay.
There's maybe a couple rows.
Okay, we'll leave that out.
Essentially none.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and there's nothing else I'm missing there. Chardonnay, Gamay is what we're looking at.
There are some other grapes planted, but not essentially it's Chardonnay and Gamay.
Okay.
Other grapes tend to be planted in desperation.
In desperation, yeah.
Because a winemaker is trying to diversify his offering or something. Yeah, but there's that's not entirely true because there are some winemakers who just don't work within the Beaujolais AOC system who have planted some other varieties. But essentially, it is, to not complicate things, it's Gamay.
Okay.
And some Chardonnay.
And it's predominantly red that's produced there. I think it's a really, really small percentage of the white that's produced there.
Yeah.
And a teeny tiny percentage of rosé from Gamay there.
Yeah,
inconsequential, basically.
Inconsequential.
Okay. Yeah.
Most of the whites are also inconsequential.
So can you tell me why it's predominantly red? Or there's a few things I read about that. I just want to know if you have anything to say about it.
Why Beaujolais is predominantly a red wine region? That's an interesting question.
I read something about because there's some overlap with Mâcon. When people are growing white there, they'd rather label it Mâcon than Beaujolais. Does that sound right? Or was I misinformed?
Interestingly enough, in the 100 years ago, there was a lot more red wine in the Mâconnais than white wine. I'm not sure if that's really the dynamic. I think it's just Gamay is what grows well there.
Okay.
There are other regions where there's just essentially, that's what works. I think it's just kind of that.
All right. I won't try to search for something that's not there. So, and also in Beaujolais, we've got three classifications, Beaujolais Village and the Cru, correct?
Yes. The Crus of Beaujolais, yeah.
Can you maybe tell the listeners a little bit about the Cru? First of all, presumably this is the highest quality or the most well regarded the Cru are above the other two. Would you say that?
That's the
general thinking.
Yeah, I mean it tends to be the better terroir. The way it's organized, you have the greater Beaujolais, just what they call Beaujolais tout court, just Beaujolais. And that tends to be, well, it's most of the south of the Appalachian as you get closer to Lyon. And then it's the more kind of sandy clay, flatter soils that are near towards the Saône River, which is north of Lyon between Mâcon and Lyon there. And then going up into the more pure granite soils, the steeper sites around the Creus, you have the Beaujolais Village Appalachian. And there's many different villages that can make Beaujolais Village. And then you have the 10 Creus of Beaujolais, which they are, you know, ideal, you know, theoretically those are going to be the best terroir, but there's fantastic terroir in Beaujolais Village as well, for much less price in terms of the vines and the bottles of wine as well.
And for the listeners who might not be familiar with the Cru, you might recognize some of the names, Morgon, Saint-Amour, Moulin-Avant. I think those are some of the Cru that I feel like I see more often here, at least on the shelves or...
Yeah, of course.
I'm not saying they're the better ones. I'm just saying those names. I think you'll find that on almost every cafe, I think.
So, I mean, not all the crews are really created equal. They definitely all have their own identity. In terms of these days, I don't want to say irrelevant to talk about the terroir, but it's of secondary importance to the amount of good winemakers working in a given area.
Okay, that's interesting because you hear so much talk about terroir in France in terms of winemaking. So what's differentiating things or making them better or lesser quality? It's just the work that the winemakers are doing or?
Yeah. Obviously, you know, you can't, if you really have absolutely horrible terroir, you're not going to be able to produce much with it. But the key thing is, and this applies to more than the Beaujolais, this applies to every wine region on earth, arguably, is that since the 1970s and 1980s, there's been an explosion of enological products that has really diversified the way that people make wine, individual winemakers. And so you can have two winemakers working on adjacent or practically identical sites, but if one of them is using aromatic yeasts, acidifiers, colorants, heavy filtration, and so forth, they're going to wind up with a completely different product to another winemaker working in a more natural way beside them.
Well, which is, you're a big proponent of natural wines and natural, biodynamic, organic. That's pretty much the focus of Not Drinking Poison in Paris of your site, no?
Yeah, essentially. I tend to cover that, but I don't see them as being super dissociable with just the notion of quality itself.
Yeah. Well, I think my personal experience is in a lot of kind of smaller winemaking regions, people are making wines, they're just making them naturally, but they're not necessarily saying this is a natural wine. So yeah, I think that... people can be making quality wines and not necessarily in natural ways and not necessarily marketing them as natural.
Yeah, I mean, that applies to Domaine de la Romanée Conti, or that applies to a lot of famous winemakers, who certainly the ones who became famous before this kind of scission in the industry, schism in the industry arose. One of the things that appealed to me about writing about the Beaujolais is that when I was initially conceiving the book, was I thought it would be an interesting region to write about because I wouldn't have to really talk too much about the natural non-natural divide, because the greats of the Beaujolais working there almost all working naturally. It's almost uncontroversial within the industry.
Okay.
There are some exceptions, but it's almost uncontroversial at this point. In critical opinion in the wine world is not super divided on that.
Okay. Something that I've heard about sort of when I've read or heard about Beaujolais is this term carbonic maceration. And now I'm not a wine idiot, but I'm also not an expert. But that is something that I'm not really familiar with. Is that something important for us to talk about? Is it a little too geeky?
Do you have several hours?
Okay, well...
Well, I think the one wonderful thing that would be great to cry far and wide about this, about carbonic maceration, is that... Even seasoned sommeliers, even wine industry professionals, they tend to look no further than the term carbonic maceration. They'll say, "Oh, it's got fruit, it's carbonic, I get it," and that's a massive, massive fallacy. It's an extremely simplistic way of understanding it. There are as many ways to perform a carbonic or semi-carbonic maceration as there are to do a Burgundian heavy de-stemming super pigiage, a lot of foot crushing and punching down. There's as many styles of each as there are of the other. The problem is if we're very used to a Burgundian style of maceration, which is that's the traditional red wine style of maceration in many parts of the world, then whenever you taste something from the Beaujolais or another or any other region on earth that's made with carbonic maceration, you assume that that's what's giving all of the qualities of it. It's a perspective issue, essentially.
Okay.
But in a nutshell, what carbonic is, maybe that would be useful.
Yeah. I'm not even sure I have a full understanding of it. So, I mean, just a very basic idea.
Essentially, it's carbonic maceration is when you're taking whole cluster grapes, you're putting them in the tank, and often there'll be some juice created in the bottom of the tank from the whole cluster, the weight of the grapes on top, crushing the ones on bottom. That juice starts fermenting. The tank fills with CO2. Or there are some winemakers who will fill it with CO2. And what you're creating is an anaerobic environment, an environment without oxygen. And when you put grapes in an environment without oxygen, there's an enzymatic fermentation that occurs within the grape berries. And so since you're not macerating the grapes on the skins and the stems and the seeds, you don't get the extraction of tannins and color that you would doing it that way. So that's why it's a style of maceration that yields lighter, silkier wines. There's another misunderstanding floating around, which is that carbonic maceration masks terroir in some way or another. It's simply not the case. You spend any time tasting down there and tasting adjacent winemakers, and you realize there's an entire universe of carbonic and semi-carbonic maceration.
Okay. So you're researching for a potential book. So is it just going to look at the entire region? Can you, without maybe giving too much away, do you want to talk a little bit about what you have in mind, how you want to introduce Beaujolais to the world?
As long as it doesn't oblige me to eventually produce that book. the way that I would like to ideally produce the information or present the information would be as just a fairly simple, rigorous guide to the various areas of the region, the kind of little micro cultures and subcultures that you get down there, the different styles of winemaking, different schools of thought that are pertinent and in circulation down there these days, and with lists of winemakers, with talks about their house style, essentially that.
Sounds like a good comprehensive guide. Are there any particular regions that you want to talk about or you think stand out there or worth sharing with the listeners, diving further into?
I think the most relevant regions in terms of the relevant areas of the region where there are the most kind of legendary cult winemakers tends to be around Fleury and Morgon. There's a certain axis there, and that of course is also, it was kind of, Beaujolais is also little known, it's little known or little recognized, but within the greater worldwide kind of natural wine phenomenon, Beaujolais was arguably the cradle for it. It was where the winemaker Marcel Lapierre, late winemaker, in Morgon began working with two other winemakers, Jacques Néoport and Jules Chauvet, to do experiments on low sulfur and no sulfur vinification. And Marcel ended up becoming really proselytizing for that and kind of spreading the gospel of low and zero sulfur winemaking to many other regions in France and worldwide. So he was based in Morgon. So around Morgon, and to a slightly lesser extent, but a pretty great extent these days, Fleury, you have a real nest of dynamic natural winemakers working now. But at this point, the whole region is a real hotbed of fascinating natural winemakers.
Now, because it is the Beaujolais Nouveau is arriving this month. Can we talk a little bit about Beaujolais Nouveau?
Sure.
So I feel like it gets a bad rap. Does it deserve that bad rap?
It depends what you ask from it, you know.
What should we ask from it?
I think, and this applies to not just Beaujolais Nouveau, but many, many inexpensive wines. I think we often ask a lot too much of wine, particularly on the export market. In France, in another wine, you know, historical wine producing nations, there's a more kind of a workmanlike use of wine as a beverage, as a refreshment, and one doesn't necessarily always consider it to be a luxury product evocative of world travel and vacation and the good life, which is, seems to be the way wine as a subject is often perceived in the USA and elsewhere. And Beaujolais Nouveau is intended to be a simple wine. There are a lot of wonderful Beaujolais Nouveau out there, particularly if a good winemaker makes terrific wines, they're not going to make a terrible Nouveau. It's really about following the winemaker, the person behind the wine, rather than following the vintage or following where the wine is really coming from specifically, because a good winemaker is going to make an interesting wine regardless of the vintage.
But what brought about the Beaujolais Nouveau? I mean, so for the listeners, in case you don't know, it's wine that's released and then it's drunk within, is it a few weeks or a few months of being bottled?
Well, you're not legally obliged to drink it quickly.
Oh. No. Well, it's released.
It's released, yeah. Very, very early, you know, just weeks after the harvest. And that's what another kind of misunderstanding about Beaujolais Nouveau is, I think because it's a simple wine, people tend to assume it's simple to produce, but it's actually extraordinarily difficult to produce a good Beaujolais Nouveau. Even a staple one is difficult to produce, let alone a delicious and healthful one.
Is this because it's not aging, so it's not going to round out, and also there's, you know, no preserve, not sulfites, there's nothing to consistent, or is
it? Well, I mean, the great majority of Beaujolais Nouveau is awful. But I would also argue that the great majority of all wine is awful. So, for example, the reason it's difficult, to get back to that, is that you're picking the grapes and it's fermenting very, very briefly, and then when you're making any other wine that's going to see release much later in the year, say it's being released as early as February or March, or if it's being released in June after the harvest, there's a time for the wine to kind of get whole during the élevage, during the period of élevage, whether it's in tank or whether it's in barrel. And that's a process through which, of course, the wine's going to... There's obviously a lot of ways that winemakers intervene to stabilize their wines, but in the kind of Platonic ideal of it, you know, this should be... It's a time where the wine is coming into its own because all of the particles in suspension, they're clarifying out and all these things. If you don't have that time, if your wine is being released, is being shipped to Tokyo and Lord knows where, you know, just a few weeks after it's being picked, there's a lot of incentive for winemakers to use rather invasive processes to get them to clarify, to get them to stabilize. They'll filter the heck out of them. Even many natural winemakers who otherwise don't filter any of their red wines will filter their Beaujolais Nouveau, which is a shame. It's a commercial pressure. Many of the more conscientious winemakers kind of lament the fact that the demand of the market obliges them to make Beaujolais Nouveau and to ship it quickly. And they're saying they'd rather, you know, they've got these perfectly good grapes, they'd rather just release it in December or January and just have a little more time to make it a better wine.
But what's making it, why can't they? Why do they have to release it as Beaujolais Nouveau? Is it coming from Beaujolais Nouveau AOC? But that's also just the Beaujolais AOC, isn't it?
Yeah, they could always just release it later.
So they don't have to release a Nouveau.
Well, it's their importers.
I'm sure there are importer demands.
The retailers are complaining to the importers saying they need it that night. So it's a fairly cheap and simplistic marketing effort in the end, you know.
Yeah.
Beaujolais Nouveau. I mean, for me, I think I've got a totally hopeless and idealistic but radical vision for what Beaujolais Nouveau could be, And you can experience, people can experience that when they come to Paris, for example. If you're in Paris, to a certain extent in Lyon, there's a circuit of very, very conscientious, rigorous natural wine bars that will present really, really excellent Beaujolais Nouveau. Not only is it wonderful, but you can even find unfiltered Beaujolais Nouveau, which is, that should be like a, you know, Beaujolais Lyonnais truffle, you know, because this is something that is hard to find. There's only like three or four guys even bothering to produce an unfiltered Beaujolais Nouveau. It's a wonderful thing. It's Guy Berton, for instance, he very rarely filters his Beaujolais Nouveau. Xavier Benier, I think, also rarely filters his Beaujolais Nouveau. There's a young winemaker in Fleury called Jan Bertrand, who he only 1 year so far has made a Beaujolais Nouveau, but he didn't filter it. He went to crazy lengths to make sure he wouldn't have to filter it, and it was a gorgeous wine. And these, when you taste these wines, you begin to understand why this became a thing in the first place, why there was, where the soul of the subject is. But of course, they're nearly unavailable almost everywhere.
Well, you've inspired me. Now I want to try them this year. So might have to bother you later to find out where they might be available. I mean, are they available all in Paris, or are these things that you have to go to the winemaker to get?
No. I mean, there's a lot of wine bars around Paris that will have some. Of course, even this is a much longer subject, but even the natural wine bars won't necessarily say which of their Beaujolais Nouveau are filtered, because a lot of the great natural winemakers are making good filtered Beaujolais Nouveau as well.
Okay. So in the States, I haven't lived in the States for a long time, but I do remember around, you know, right around Thanksgiving, the Georges de Boeuf Beaujolais Nouveau would pop up in Trader Joe's and all over. And I don't know if you've spent any time there recently, but what is the Beaujolais Nouveau scene like outside of France? Do you know?
It's a choice grown? It's a big subject. You know? I spent Beaujolais Nouveau in Japan once in Tokyo. That was interesting.
Yeah.
With a good natural winemaker there doing the rounds. I've lived in Paris for the last 10 years essentially. So
yeah.
I'm not super familiar with how Beaujolais Nouveau is being marketed in the States these days. I mean, I think it's the same thing as, you know, if we're, yeah, to use a comparison, like, it's hip in America to talk about grower champagne, which is, you know, they're trying to use that phrase to differentiate champagne from that's produced by people who grow their own grapes, rather than the big houses like Veuve Clicquot and that kind of thing, which is a nice distinction to make, but it doesn't go very far actually, because there's growers who make terrible champagne and there's growers who make excellent champagne. It's in the end, it's relatively wishy-washy. Mm-hmm. And I think when it comes down to Beaujolais Nouveau, the good ones are being made by the famous natural winemakers, people like Jean Foyard, Georges Descombes, Chateau Cambon, which is Jean-Claude Chanoudet and Marie Lapierre. Those are the ones, you know, that you can find, you know, relatively widely in the States these days, and that are fantastic and that really transmit some of the original joyousness and pleasure of this thing called Beaujolais Nouveau.
So do you have plans to be out drinking Beaujolais Nouveau here when it comes out in Paris this year?
Almost certainly, unless I happen to be elsewhere. But yeah, I definitely will do a circuit. I mean, I usually do what's called, my friend Meg calls it the Beaujolais Nouveau Death March, because we try to hit like a circuit of bars, about 8 or 10, passing through all excellent natural wine bars, and we go from one to the other, kind of ricocheting across Paris, and we're swaying by the end of it. Yeah. But it's a wonderful night in Paris. I think I described it once on the blog as being like a cross between Thanksgiving and New Year's Eve, because a lot of the great winemakers come up to Paris. They spend time with their clients, the restaurants and wine bars, and so as someone visiting Paris or as someone who lives in Paris, you can really feel a connection to the culture of the winemakers of Beaujolais that evening if you go to the right places.
Very good. Yeah, I think I've been invited to that death march and I have avoided it, but now I feel like I really missed out. Well, is there anything else that you feel like, you know, I know we've covered a lot of ground, but very surfacey. I know that we could go a lot deeper on all of these, but my listeners, we only have a half hour.
A 19-hour podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
We'd have the
entire podcast would be dedicated to Beaujolais. But is there anything else that you think is worth sharing, or you think that is really important to point out in terms of Beaujolais or Beaujolais Nouveau?
I think the best way to consider both subjects, Beaujolais Nouveau as the kind of the one subject and then the wider subject of the wines of Beaujolais is that it's good to avoid blanket generalizations. I mean, that applies to any wine region. I think living over in France, I'm sure you feel this as well. When people start to talk about the whole subject of French wine, it's like you want to immediately explain that there's no such thing as French wine. There's wine from all these different regions that had these long historical winemaking cultures before France ever unified as a nation. You know, Burgundy used to be part of, Belgium, basically. You know, like it's an older thing than that. And so it's hard to generalize about French wine, hard to generalize about all of Beaujolais. Yeah. It's best to follow the winemakers.
Yeah, well, I think that's kind of good advice in general. It's hard to generalize about things in life, but yeah. Well, and also for the readers, I will put links to Aaron's blog. So if you want to dive a lot deeper into all these subjects, he writes some pretty long and extensive and informative and opinionated and in a good way posts about his different travels all around France and Beaujolais and French wine and
a lot of Beaujolais.
Yeah, a lot of Beaujolais. All right. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to come down and speak with me.
My pleasure.
And I look forward to reading the book when you get it out there.
Publish it.
Yeah, sounds good. All right. So that's pretty much a wrap for this month's episode. If you're looking for more talk in between shows, you can head over to the site. It's www.52martinis.com. If you'd like to carry me around in your pocket, you can download our iOS app called Paris Cocktails, and it's a guide to Paris cocktail bars. As always, thank you to today's guest and to you listeners for tuning in or downloading. And as usual, remember, drink responsibly. And finally, I just want to take a second to read out an iTunes review, and this one happens to come from Emily Dilling. So even if you know me and you work with me on the podcast, you can leave a review. And Emily says, as someone who lived in Paris for 10 years and has since moved away, I love how this podcast speaks to Paris natives and the Paris curious. 52 Martinis has never led me astray when it comes to exploring nightlife in the city. And this podcast brings that knowledge, experience, and people featured in the blog together in one fun to listen to place. So we really appreciate getting those reviews. So if you like what we're doing, please hop over to iTunes and drop us a quick review. And until next time, cheers.